So we're still on the first introduction, and I can't even promise we're going to finish it today. I've got this beautiful structure, but beautiful structures tend to take a long time to develop. But it would be nice to get beyond the introduction, but we'll just see how it goes. Let me summarize where we are and where we're going. Last week, I began laying out what I took to be the problem of the relationship between determining judgment and reflective judgment. Determining judgment, again, is that judgment which subsumes particulars under universals when the universal is already given. Reflective judgment is that judgment that occurs when the particular is given and the universal is yet to be found. It's the activity of searching for an adequate universal. And I suggested initially that we can see how the issue of reflecting judgment arises when we look at three features of ordinary empirical judgments, namely learning new concepts. How is it possible to learn a new concept? And the reason why it's an issue is because under that occasion, we're presented with something and we do not yet know what concept it falls under, or conversely, we're told a new concept, but we don't know what objects it applies to. So there's this question of how we fit together our awareness of individuals, intuitions, in Kant's jargon, and universals. So in learning new concepts, we must be able to have some form of cognitive engagement with particulars before they are subsumed under a concept, which is what the work of judgment is, subsuming under concepts. Secondly, even in applying ordinary concepts, we have to have... Now, let me put the question this way. In what way does experience, however we're going to interpret experience, in what way does experience guide judgment concept application? That is, we typically assume, and the problem, the reason why these problems are difficult to get a hold of is because we walk around the world and it's already completely coded with concepts. We walk down the street and there's nothing we don't automatically see as already conceptualized. But in order for that to occur, that object that creeps into our sight must somehow, it must trigger, right, the concept. The question is, what's that triggering operation? How do individuals in the world guide, tell us which concepts they want to fall under, what they need to fall under, what they're supposed to fall under? How is that? Is this just magic? Right? And of course, for most Kantians, it is magic. Right? This was the debate I had with my supervisor, W.H. Walsh, right? He just thought the idea of unconceptualized particulars was a nonsense. And then the third problem, therefore, is the analogous one. This is where the ordinary application problem becomes overt. When we have to extend a given concept to a new situation. Someone has something in their hand, and they're going to tell me I'm supposed to apply the concept telephone to it, right? I have a hard time adjusting to this, right? Mostly I'm walking down the street and I think all the people around me are crazy because they're talking to themselves. Then they're talking into a machine. Oh, that makes it better. It took me ages to figure out what was going on. I'm very slow on technological uptake. But the point is, between those, you know, things we used to have with dials and all that, we extend the concept. How do we do that? How do we, you know, fix new individuals under older concepts, widen the concept appropriately? So I said that there is something puzzling, and I just want to feel the depth of the puzzle, about the relationship between individuals and concepts. Now, it just so happens, in the second step, I suggested that there are three areas in which the argument of the critique of pure reason, which establishes, again, the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience, right? that solution, the establishment that there are the categories of substance and causality and reciprocity and the forms of space and time, once we learn all that, I suggested that we still are a far way from having anything like actual experience. And I said there were three obvious gaps or areas of underdetermination of transcendental philosophy. First of all, it had no way of talking about the individual as such. Indeed, it seems to argue that the idea of the individual as such is an unintelligible idea. Right? Because intuitions without concepts are blind. Yet, we have an idea that there's a notion of specificity, of concreteness, of irreducibility about the particular, and that just, for example, fixing it as in this place, in this time, doesn't get at its concreteness. Of course, we have conceptual mechanisms for fixing individuality, but that's already, right, conceptually determining it. It doesn't mean to be aware of the individual as such.
What role does qualitative identity play?
Kant thinks that qualitative identity is necessary but not sufficient for the individuation of particulars. And the reason he thinks that is he thinks it's arguing against Leibniz, against the identity of indiscernibles. And the reason he thinks that is, first of all, you may say it just looks as if there might be millions of objects that are just about as identical as could be. Right? But the real counter to the argument of the identity of indiscernibles, is it comes too late. By which I mean, as you all know, the famous story, you know, Leibniz said to the king, look, if you don't believe me, look at the tree and compare any two leaves. Right? And you will see that each is qualitatively distinct. That is, each one will have a different qualitative property than every other one. And Kant says, any two leaves? Where did you get two leaves from? Right? And the answer is spatial position. So even abstract spaces clearly are themselves qualitatively identical. 1 square foot is, you know, 1 square foot, but they can be individuated by their position in space. Okay? So Kant always wants to use space as necessary for individuation. What we're interested here, however, is what it means to engage with a particular as such, where the best examples I can give, right, and the reason we are fascinated with it is, say, a particular work of art, say, a painting. Right? When we look at Lavender Mist, we do all sorts of things, but somehow we think it is unique. And it's that notion of uniqueness that Kant doesn't seem to be able to quite get a hold of with his conceptual scheme. The second area is we must, he says, presuppose, in ways I'll talk about in a moment, that any particular we come across falls under some empirical concept or other. That is, if it's true that intuitions without concepts are blind, then the idea of an in principle irreducible one, which has no conceptual relationship to any other, Kant thinks is unintelligible. But more importantly, in our ordinary empirical life, when we come across some object, we assume it is conceptualizable. That is, it is not a mere raw particular, but in principle, intelligible. And further, and this is the only argument I really did in any detail last week, for the sake of science, we are faced with the possibility that we could have laws, but that those laws be disjunctive, that there are laws of how things are on the moon, but they're different from how things are on the Earth, which are different from how things are, take a really strange place, Australia, right? Totally different laws, nothing operates the same in Australia. Right? Now, if it was true that there was simply the diversity of laws, science would be impossible. Scientific inquiry presupposes that concepts can be brought under wider concepts, laws can be brought under wider laws until they are all brought under one unified conceptual apparatus, like Newton's laws of motion. That's your paradigm. Now, in order for this third one to work out, we had to introduce a new principle of reflection. That is, I suggested that science must approach nature as if scientific inquiry were possible, that is, as if for any laws, wider and broader laws could be found under which those narrow laws could be brought. So that scientific inquiry is teleological or purposive intellectual activity, and it is guided by this idea of, let's call it, a unity of the world under law, and that presupposes what Kant calls, in paragraph 4, page 209 of the second introduction, the principle of the purposiveness of nature. Therefore, it is subjectively necessary for us to make the transcendental presupposition. Notice it's transcendental. Why transcendental? Because it's necessary condition for the possibility of scientific inquiry. The transcendental presupposition that nature has experience possible for us does not have this disturbing, boundless heterogeneity of empirical laws and heterogeneity of natural forms, but that rather through the affinity of its particular laws under more general ones, it takes on the quality of experience as an empirical system. That's principles of the purposiveness of nature. Now, it's a puzzling principle. Again, this is where we ended last week, because it's not actually about nature. It's actually about how we must reflectively regard nature for the sake of our empirical investigations of it. So that unlike the categories which are legislative of nature, unlike the moral law, which is legislative of freedom, the principle of the purposiveness of nature is not legislative of any ontological domain. What it legislates is roughly itself. That is, the activity of judgment. It's something there for the sake of judgment. And therefore, I suggested at the end of last week that Kant is here proposing a normative and not either an epistemological or an ontological solution to the problem of induction. That is, he's legislating the presuppositions for rational activity and not for any object domain. That is why what I skipped over last week in the first, I'm sorry, in the second introduction, he introduces the notion of quotonomy. Page 185.6 in the second introduction, one of those typically puzzling Kantian things.
185?
Yeah, the very, very end of 185, the beginning of 186. It's the very beginning of the paragraph. Hence, judgment also possesses an a priori. No. First, second introduction, the published one.
Second introduction.
Hence, judgment also possesses an a priori principle for the possibility of nature, but one that holds, here's the twist, right? Transcendental principle for the possibility of nature. Sounds like it's going to be ontological. But then he takes it all back and he says, no. But one that holds only for the subject a principle by which judgment prescribes not to nature, which would be autonomy, but to itself, which is hautonomy, a law for its reflection on nature. This law could be called the law of the specification of nature in terms of empirical laws. Okay, that is where we ended last week. Any questions before I muddy the water? Okay. What I've done is said something about level 3, and that leaves us with levels 2 and 1. That is, what I've done is vindicate, or begun vindicating, the notion of reflective judgment with respect to scientific inquiry. I still have not explained the systematic relation between reflective judgment and determining judgment with respect to problems 1 and 2. And that's what I need to do today, or at least get some way down that path. And what I want to do today, just to keep things simple, since it's going to be unbearably difficult later on, today keep it simple, I'm today going to present the argument in the form in which it appears more or less in Allison. And I'll explain at the end of the hour what's absolutely wrong about Allison, but we'll just stay with what I'm going to call the Longuin, since Allison himself is copying Beatrice Longuinesse. We're going to call this the Longuinesse-Allison hypothesis. It's an hypothesis that Kant himself never states, and yet it is what makes the third critique important for questions of epistemology. Did I put Rebecca Kukla's book on your reading list?
Collected Essays.
Is it on the reading list?
It's on reserve.
It's on reserve. There's a new book edited by Rebecca Kukla that's all about the relationship between aesthetics and epistemology, called something like Aesthetics and Epistemology in Kant.
Cognition.
Nice one. Okay. Here's the Longuinesse-Allison hypothesis. This was this thought, which I'm going to read in one sentence, takes Longuinesse something like 380 pages to work out in amazing detail. I am still in awe of the detail of her argument when I can follow it. It's an immensely difficult book, but immensely rewarding. And the hypothesis is quite simple. It states that all theoretical judgments, including, indeed, especially ordinary empirical judgments of empirical states of affairs, contain what might be termed a moment of reflection as well as determination. Stated again, that all theoretical judgments contain a moment of reflection as well as determination. Or, if you like to speak in Kantianese, determining judgment presupposes, in every instance, a moment of reflecting judgment, or again, no determining judgment without reflecting judgment. Okay. Well, we have, and the way I started the hour was meant to do this, already seen why this might be the case, namely the problem of learning, applying, and extending concepts indicate that there is an intrinsic moment of indeterminacy with respect to each determinate judgment. And that moment of indeterminacy, again, is it cannot specify itself its conditions of application. It cannot explain the possibility of learning new concepts, and above all, it cannot explain the extension of existing concepts to new circumstances. These are mark a fundamental incompleteness in the idea of conceptual determination. And for the purposes to hand, the example that Allison focuses on, as does nearly everyone, is the question of the acquiring of new concepts. How do we acquire new concepts? And the answer, of course, is through complex acts of logical reflection, called the capacity to judge. Okay, so the capacity to judge is our capacity through logical reflection to acquire new concepts. Okay, now I'm going to make your life miserable. The way in which... That, I'm afraid, was the end of the easy bit for the evening. This problem arises in the context of the Critique of Pure Reason with respect to what Kant calls the problem of schematism. Or at least, in order to get at this problem in the context of Kantian thought, you have to work through the problem of schematism. What on earth is the notion of schematism? And what does it have to do with reflective judgment? The problem of schematism in Kant is meant to answer one of the oldest problems of philosophy, namely the question of how something that is a concept or something that is purely intelligible can be applied to something that is not only individual, but sensible. That is, how do conceptual things hook on to sensible things? And in the context of the Critique of Pure Reason, you might say that the problem is exiguously difficult. And the reason why the problem is exiguously difficult is because the Critique of Pure Reason begins with the problem of the missing empirical experience. Namely, when you looked for the notion of cause, right? Looked at the world, he didn't see anything corresponding to that concept. Rather, what he saw is first one thing happened, and then something else happened. And he said, there is no such thing as cause. There are just regularities, empirical regularities. And much of the Critique of Pure Reason was designed to answer you on the basis of the thought that the universe really is not a matter of mere regularities, but a matter of... Hey, Shmuel, how are you? Good. All the way from Norway. Okay. Just continue the conversation where we left it off. That Kant took it for granted that indeed the universe was, that the glue of the universe was causal laws and not mere regularities, and he thought therefore the notion of mere regularities underdetermined the notion of causality. And therefore, he equally knew, and now he had the puzzle, that if he was going to have the notion of cause and effect, he knew that he would not find anything that looked like cause or anything that looked like effect, right? That's what you rightly said wasn't there. You don't see the way you see green or yellow or cat or dog or cell phone, you don't see cause. So Kant argues that, as I suggested in the first week, cause is necessary, causal talk, causal forms of thought are necessary in order to distinguish, I suggested, subjective from sensation, the way I order direction of the way I look at a house, from objective succession, namely things that really do happen one after the other. So the question then becomes, how does the notion of causality get a grip on the sensible world? We seem to have this gap between the intelligible and the sensible, the very gap that is at the heart of Platonic metaphysics. And we realize that if we are going to have judgment at all, we're going to have to cross this gap. We're going to have to somehow connect the merely conceptual with the sensible. So Kant suggests that there must be, between the sensible and the intelligible, between concept and intuition, a third thing. Whenever in doubt, add a third thing. Right? A lot of you have a lot of sexual experience I don't have. That's fine. The third thing is also going to be between that which does our thinking, the understanding, which is the faculty of concepts, and that which is that through which we are aware of particulars, namely our sensibility. We need some way of connecting the understanding and the sensibility between mind and body. And the third thing in terms of a faculty is going to be the imagination. And schematism is going to be an operation of the imagination. The imagination, why is the imagination, and not just imagination, we're going to call it the productive imagination. And the notion of productive imagination is immensely felicitous for what we need. It's immensely felicitous for what we need because, on the one hand, if it's productive, it's active. The way the understanding is active. It's spontaneous. It creates. It makes. On the other hand, what it makes are images. That is, things that have a moment of passivity. So the imagination is neither wholly active, like the understanding, nor wholly passive, like sensibility, but a third thing in the middle. Now, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, what the imagination does for every single one of the categories is find, it temporalizes the concepts. That is, the way in which the categories, which are the pure concepts we're interested in, reach experience is through an act of imaginative temporalization. So in the case of causality, right, it is, will apply just in case one event succeeds, that is, comes after another in accordance with a determinate rule. That's what causality is, right? It is temporal succession under a determinate rule. And the same will hold for all the other categories. So on B 183, if you're interested in particular reason, he explains the way in which all the categories are temporalized. Now, that this occurs and what allows us to heave a sigh of relief is that all this happens automatically, without any reflection whatsoever. It is, as Kant says, an art hidden in the depths of the soul. So this act of temporalization occurs. So at least with respect to the categories, we do not have a problem of judgment, Kant says. Schematism, procedure of finding an image, something that is itself empirical for any concept, happens automatically in the case of categories. So no rules are necessary for transcendental schemata. Empirical concepts, it turns out, are going to be very different. So what we want to do, or what the question of reflective judgment, the question of reflective judgment is going to pick up. And indeed, this is an odd bit, but on the whole, reflective judgment does the work of the relating of sensibility to imagination that happens through the imagination alone in the Critique of Pure Reason. So that the notion of sensibility almost drops out of the third critique altogether, and he'll just talk about empirical reflective judgments. Now, why do we have this problem? As I said, it's going to be the question of how we acquire concepts. And what makes this deep for Kant is because, and this is often... this is important since most people misread Kant on this. According to Longuenesse and Allison, neither the categories, cause and effect, nor the forms of intuition, space and time, are innate. Rather, the forms of intuition and the categories are acquired from the synthetic activities of the imagination under the direction of the logical functions of judgment. The logical functions of judgment, subject predicate, that kind of stuff, are innate. So, initially, we might say, we need reflective judgment even to explain how the categories themselves gain access to the world, because they gain it through the way in which they regulate ordinary empirical concepts. But ordinary empirical concepts are not innate, not given, but must be generated. Okay. The notion of schema will become clearer as we go on. Reflection is a work of comparison. So the first question, so Kant is going to be suggesting a version of concept formation through abstraction, as it's classically called. And he has to solve, and I'll say what all the problems are, all the problems that the theory of abstraction faces. Reflection is a work of comparison. And the question is a comparison of what with what? Well, we know concepts have two aspects. Their generality, right? And the individual that falls under them, which is their matter. So concepts have form and matter as their moments. What do we compare? On page, at the end of page 21, Allison quotes from Kant's logic lectures, where Kant says the following. To make concepts out of representations, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make concepts out of representations. One must be able to compare, to reflect, and to abstract. Those are the three activities. Compare two items, reflect on their samenesses and differences, abstract from their differences in order to catch their sameness. Okay, so the three moments involve comparison, reflection, abstraction, for these are three logical operations of the understanding are essential and universal conditions for the generation of every concept whatsoever. And then he gives an example. I see, for example, a spruce, a willow, and a linden. How many people here could identify a linden tree? I love city dwellers. Nature is just this mush up there. A linden? By first comparing these objects with one another, I note that they are different from one another in regard to the trunk, the branches, the leaves, etc. But next, I reflect on what they have in common among themselves, trunk, branches, and leaves themselves, and I abstract from the quantity, the figure, etc. of these. Thus, I acquire the concept tree. Well, that sounds simple enough. Now, the first thing to note here, as Allison rightly says, is comparison, reflection, abstraction are not temporally successive, but a single unified activity with three analytic moments. Okay. That ain't going to help much, because the old problem of abstraction, and what has made many philosophers claim that abstraction is a bad theory of concept formation and acquisition, the old problem of abstraction is, how could one ignore certain features unless one already possessed the concept tree? That is, the problem of abstraction is the business of noting identities and differences and then ignoring the differences. Which differences do we ignore? How do we decide that some differences are not weighty? How do we decide that there are differences we can just make irrelevant unless we already have in mind the concept? That is, the concepts are, just are, that articulation of what is, let's call it, essential to a concept and what inessential. Yeah, Ruby.
But the thing is, why would you have to ignore when you can just have more specific concepts?
But then you're going to not solve, you're not going to solve then your problem of systematic laws.
Right, but what I'm saying is that, like you said, that there can be more general forms, which everything else is categorized under. So the thing is, like, if you go, you can go to be more general, and you can also go to be more specific.
Both. You have to do both.
So then, isn't
both of them are part of scientific inquiry. Mm-hmm. Still leaves the problem of how we do that, how we know what to ignore, right? And we know, by the way, that there are cultures for which the way we divvy up nature doesn't, you know, totally match. Now, this problem of abstraction has a special depth for Kant because, again, we could not apply categories without empirical concepts. You can't apply the notion of causality directly. You have to apply it to some event. Water freezing. Therefore, you have to have the concept of water, you have to have the notion of freezing, and then you can begin to think causally. Okay. So categories depend on empirical concepts for their application, and we know already that they are insufficient to account for concept acquisition. So we need to think a bit harder about the logical act of comparison. Well, even animals have association of ideas. Right? Cartoon animals are great at this, right? You know, the cartoon wolf comes along, sees a lamb, and then flashes up a little thing, you know, picture of a beautiful rack of lamb all steaming, right? Perfect association of ideas, right? Lambs, lamb chops. Lambs, dinner. When my son, Dan, was about 4 years old, we lived in a little village called Wivenhoe with farms all around it. And I took him out for a walk along the country path in springtime. And there were the tiny little lambs gambling over. And I said, "Dan, look, look at all the lambs." And he went, "Yum, yum." He's not a vegetarian. So, even animals and four-year-olds have association of ideas. The crux, according to Longuenesse, is that comparison is always universalizing, that is, tending toward generality. And the reason it is tending towards generality, that is, directed toward the detection of common features in the sensibly given, is because the activity of comparison is in the service of the logical functions of judgment. That is, we are looking, as it were, for generality. Because we are looking for objects that can stand in the subject, substance, place, or in the predicate, property, place of our judging activities. That is, since we are already structured to judge the world, then we are, when we encounter the world, we bring that apparatus to it, and we are therefore always searching for common features of the sensibly given. And that this search for the common features occurs under the guidance of what are called the concepts of comparison. And these concepts of comparison are delineated in a chapter of the critique called the Amphiboly. That's what it's called. The Amphiboly of Concepts, which is an engagement, in fact, with Leibniz. And where Kant says there that the work of reflection occurs under the operation of four couples, namely identity and difference, agreement and opposition, inner and outer, matter and form.
Could you just repeat that, please?
Yeah. Identity and difference, agreement and opposition, inner and outer, matter and form. It's B319A263, and I'm not going to spend time dwelling on those. Down that path lies madness. As interesting as, but by the way, Longuenes does dwell on them. Only Longuenes, even Allison is frightened off of talking about them in detail. But nonetheless, we still have not got an answer to my original question, namely, what is being compared with what to produce what? In one of his reflections, these are just little notes in a notebook of Kant, and you know we're desperate, right? We can find nothing in the main text, and they're hunting through these scrapbooks of his, right? You know, anything, you know, written on the backs of envelopes. So on the back of an envelope, namely R2880, he says, we compare only what is universal in the rule of our apprehension. Let me repeat that, because I'm going to beat the hell out of that incomprehensible phrase. We compare only what is universal in the rule of our apprehension. Well, remember that, maybe you can remember because maybe I haven't told you, apprehension is a technical term in Kant, like every other term. And it is the original work of the imagination in its operation on the sensibly given. So the original business of gathering up the inputs of the senses is the idea of apprehending them, not comprehending them. Comprehension requires concepts. We're just in the business here of apprehension. So we compare only what is universal in the rule of our apprehension. That is, we say that our apprehension of a sensibly given is itself, by the imagination, is itself rule governed, which is to say there's some rule articulating how this sensibly given is held together. So a rule of the sensibly given, well, that's a schema. So it looks as if what we do when we want to form a concept is compare schemata. Now it's important here, the reason that Allison and Longuenes are so keen on the idea that we compare schemata is because they are not either raw images or raw impressions. Schemata are rules governing particular image formations or rules articulating particular image clusters, but they are themselves, right? They have that moment of universality. There's something concept-like, not a concept, but concept-like about them. And I want you to put lots of questions, concept like, what's he talking about? Well, that's the puzzle. That's the puzzle. What does this schemata mean? Concept like? How are we going to do this? Well, Allison's first hypothesis, his first solution, occurs on the top of page 25, and he says there that, after talking about the tree again, he says, what one is really comparing are the patterns or rules governing the apprehension of these terms. That is their schemata. And it is from a reflection on what is common to these patterns of apprehension. So the patterns of apprehension, and the best way of thinking about a pattern of apprehension, the people who understand patterns of apprehension perfectly are people under the age of 5. Right? Because ask anyone under 5 to draw a tree, and they will, right? You know, do it, and then they'll get little leaves, or I don't know how to do it, right? But they'll do something like that. That for them. They know how bad I am at drawing. Like a 4-year-old. Something like this. So, but the point is that they assume there is a patterning of trunk, branches, leaves, and any something like that patterning, the generality of that pattern, is what they take tree to mean, right? Without knowing anything, it's the patterning of that sensible form. So, it is from reflection on what is common to these patterns of apprehension, or schemata, combined with an abstraction from their differences, that one arrives eventually at the reflected concept of tree. Well, two questions arise here. Namely, the same two questions all over again. This is just going to, you know, this doesn't seem to have solved the problem. The questions are, how is it possible to have a schema without a concept? And how does the schema of an empirical concept originate? Well, the answer to the first question is easy, since it derives from the schematism chapter itself, which supposes that we have the concept and not the schema. So it says concepts first, then schema. But that we know cannot be right. We know it can't be right because one cannot really have a concept at all without its corresponding schema. Why can one not have a concept at all without a schema? Anyone?
There'd be nothing subsumed. Or it wouldn't be collected.
Almost.
There's no way to get back down.
You've got to get back down. You've got to know where it applies. So someone who says an orange is a round thing, that's sweet and tastes good, but walks into, you know, the fruit store and cannot pick out an orange, doesn't know how to apply the concept. So in that sense, they don't really have the concept. To have a concept is not merely to have a dictionary definition, right? Because dictionary definitions, we know, goes, you know, they one term defines another. So the dictionary is, as it were, a world of concepts without schemata. That's what dictionaries are, right? Which is why they can be frustrating. And especially if you're doing, you know, a foreign dictionary. When I read Roger's, I go crazy because I have to keep looking up every word and looking up. Yeah, Ruben.
So what would Kant think of Hegel comparing itself with itself and comparing the pattern? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Nope.
Like, consciousness, like, when you're dealing with the mediation process, according to Hegel, it's like you're dealing with consciousness. Like, both sides of the dialectic are in your consciousness, so really, like...
But that's what Kant's trying to solve here, right? He's trying to say you can't. That's what I meant when I said we can't be comparing images or raw individuals with raw images or raw individuals. That's There's no consciousness, has nothing to get a grip on. Hence, the solution, you're rightly pointing out, and this is why Hegel is interested in this kind of discussion, right, is to get it all somehow consciousness-like. Right? So the notion of schema is, so to speak, meaning to ask the question, how far towards concreteness can consciousness go and still be a work of consciousness? And yet, we want to, after all, what we're trying to do here is ask, how does the mind touch the world? Very, very carefully. So, one cannot have a concept at all without a corresponding schema, otherwise no application. Hence, Allison argues in the middle of page 25 on the notion of schema that what is required for a schema is a sensible expression or presentation. So what a schema is the sensible presentation of a concept. But now, if we're just dealing, so technically what schemas are the rules for generating sensible presentations of concepts. So what we want now, right? And therefore, without a corresponding schema, a concept can have no application. So what we're looking for now, you might say, is schema without a concept. So Allison gives the example from Kant. Is this where he does it? One more step. From the logic, Kant then gives the following example. He says, if, for example, a savage sees a house from a distance, whose use he does not know, savages, right, replace children in this literature. Interesting. Remember, philosophy hates children. If, for example, a savage sees a house, but hates savages too, of course. Especially camels. If, for example, a savage sees a house from a distance whose use he does not know, he admittedly has before him, in his representation, the very same object as someone else who knows it determinately as a dwelling established for human beings. So the first thing to say is, when people with or without a concept face a particular material object, because we are operating with broad notions of concept and object, space and time and the like, they see pretty much what we see. But as to form, this cognition of one and the same object is different in the two cases. In the former, it is mere intuition. In the latter, it is simultaneously intuition and concept. What the savage lacks, therefore, is a schema. Now, what we're pressing for here, and certainly what Allison and Longuinness want to press toward, is and I'll use the Husserlian concept here, a notion of what might be called passive synthesis. Apprehension, as I've already begun to indicate, is a work of passive synthesis. So Allison says in the middle of page 27, but after seeing many similar objects, which is talking about the savage, which he presumably relates by association, he will begin to perceive relevant similarities and differences, which in turn leads, under the implicit guidance of the concepts of comparison, to the formation of a schema of a house. Right. Again, children are very helpful. Right. House with a door in the middle. A chimney. There we go. Your schema. As a rule governing apprehension and possibly even the full-fledged concept. What is presupposed, and what I want to talk about after the break, is the, from the side of the mind, the capacity to judge. The question we have to ask is, and we still haven't answered, judge what? Right? We've got this notion of schema. We still don't have an account of how it's meant to get going. After the break, I'll tell you. So, usual break.